This is Fresh Air. On this July 4th holiday, we're featuring an interview from our archives with one of the superstars of country music, Willie Nelson. Nelson's best-known recordings include Always on My Mind, Let It Be Me, On the Road Again, and Stardust. But many of the songs he wrote were famous long before he was. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, other singers had hits with his songs Crazy, Funny How Time Slips Away, and Nightlife. When we talked to Willie Nelson in 1988, he had just come out with an album of pop standards, and he had written an autobiography. But with the rise in the past few years of young, good-looking country stars like Garth Brooks, Randy Travis, and Billy Ray Cyrus, Nelson's popularity faded. He also had problems with the IRS that got so bad he had to release an album, Who'll Buy My Memories, with an 800 number for fans to send money to. Then just this year, Willie Nelson regained his stature in the pop and country worlds with his album Across the Borderline. Let's hear the title track.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. When it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson that you must learn. You could lose more than you'll ever find. When you reach the broken promised land, when every dream slips through your hand, then you'll know that it's too late to change your mind. 'Cause you paid the price to come so far just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline.
Willie Nelson grew up in Texas and worked in the cotton fields when he was young. I asked him if that helped motivate him to write songs and perform.
Well, definitely, I knew early in life that I didn't want to be a professional cotton picker. I knew music had to be better. I would work on the side of the highway there in Abbott and see these air-conditioned Cadillacs driving by. And for a 10-year-old kid, it gave me a way to go there. I said, well, these guys must know something I don't know.
Were you exposed to a lot of different music of people singing, from people singing in the cotton fields?
Yeah, there was a lot of black singers in those days and picking cotton. And sometimes it wouldn't be unusual for 25, 30, 40 pickers in the field. And, of course, they would sing those old great old blues songs, and they would write them on the spot. It sounded like one would do a verse or a line from across the field, and someone would answer him from across the field on the other side. And sort of like having your own opera there in the cotton fields.
You established yourself as a songwriter before your reputation spread as a singer. And in your early days as a songwriter, you were royally ripped off. I don't know whether you think of it that way or not, but for instance, your song Nightlife, you sold that for $150, and it went on to be recorded by around 70 artists. It sold 30 million records over the years. How did it come to be that you sold that song for $150?
I also sold another song, Family Bible, that during the same period of time. I was in Houston, and I was married, had my kids there, and we were looking for a place to stay, and I needed some rent money. When I first hit Houston, I stopped by a club called the Esquire Club, and it was on a Monday afternoon, and there was a band rehearsing in there. And I said, well, maybe I can apply for a job here or sell some songs or something. So I introduced myself to the band leader, a guy named Larry Butler. Told him that I was a guitar player and songwriter, and asked him if he had a job open in his band, and he said, no, I didn't. So I said, well, you're looking for any songs? And he said, well, I don't know. He was recording at the time. And so I started singing him songs, and he said, well, those are pretty good songs. What do you want me to do, record them or what? I said, no, I want to sell them to you. I'll sell them to you for $10 a piece. And I'd done him 8 or 10 songs, and he said, He said, no, he said, I'm not going to buy those songs from you because they're too good of songs to sell for $10 a piece. But he said, I will loan you some money. So he let me have $50, and that was enough to put my family in get us an apartment for the week and buy a few groceries. And I never did forget that man. He's still a good friend of mine. I still see him quite often, him and his wife, Pat, and we still talk about that. He didn't buy those songs. He missed out on a good deal.
So who did buy Nightlife, and what's the story behind that?
Nightlife, I sold, actually for $100, I sold it to friends of mine, Claude Gray, Paul Buskirk, and Walt Breland, and it took all three of them to come up with $100. And those are the same guys I sold Family Bible to. So it kind of stayed in the family.
Did you get a songwriting credit, or did they buy that from you as well?
In the beginning, I didn't get the credit. Later on, a few years later, I started getting credit for it. I started getting my name back on the record.
As you became a little more established as a songwriter, did you still get cheated out of songwriting credits or royalties, or did you learn how to avoid that keep that from happening?
Well, fortunately, when I got to Nashville, I met some people. Hank Cochran was one, and Hal Smith of Pamper Music in Nashville and Goodlettsville. And I started writing for Pamper Music, and it was a good publishing company. Their accounting was honest, so I lucked out there. A lot of writers haven't been that fortunate, but I lucked out and got hooked up with a good, honest organization to begin with.
When you first went to Nashville, and I think it was 1960, you describe in your book how you really didn't have much money, so you brought a siphon with you so you could siphon off some gas for the trip.
Well, we call that the Oklahoma credit card. It used to be quite used quite often back in those days.
Well, Nashville really wasn't ready for your performing. They were ready for your songwriting. You did pretty well as a songwriter. But it was very hard for you to get started as a singer. You describe even how your singing has always been behind the beat, and in Nashville people thought you lost a sense of rhythm, that you didn't know how to carry the beat.
Only the people who didn't know music.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who knew music and could count knew that I wasn't breaking meter. The musicians, the good musicians who I played with knew that I wasn't breaking meter, that it was just phrasing. Sinatra had been doing that kind of thing for a long time. It was just a little unusual to hear a guy who's supposed to be a country singer doing that. But I had listened to Frank Sinatra and all those guys all my life, and I admired their ability to phrase, and I tried a little bit of it myself on country songs, and it was a little bit different. And the guys in Nashville had just never heard it that much.
And what was different about the songs that you were writing compared to what was on the country charts in the early 60s when you were in Nashville?
Well, they weren't what Nashville really wanted to call commercial songs. What they call commercial, of course, I was always afraid of that word, and got to the point where I was I hated the sound of the word commercial because they always used it at the wrong time. They always said, well, you know, that's a great song, but it's not commercial. And they said it about Crazy. They said it about several songs that I had written. I knew they were wrong, but it's hard to fight City Hall sometimes.
Well, just to give a sense of what pop music was like then, you describe how on top of the charts was Pat Boone's Love Letters and Debbie Reynolds' Tammy. Were you, did you see a way for yourself to fit in?
Well, of course, my heroes were guys like Ernest Tubb and Roy Acuff and these guys who had been on the Grand Ole Opry for a long time, Bob Wills, Lefty Frizzell, Hank Williams. I saw myself, I thought, being able to do what they were doing. And that's really all I was looking for, is just to, you know, get some exposure and be able to get a record out where I could play and work.
We're featuring an interview from our archives with Willie Nelson. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. back with more of our 1988 interview with Willie Nelson. One of your friends in your book comments that in the late 60s and early 70s, it was very difficult to book you into clubs because a lot of people were intimidated or even afraid of you, partly because of the way you looked, long hair, an earring in one ear. Did that seem like a problem to you? Did you feel like your looks were alienating people who might otherwise have been booking you?
Well, when I first started letting my hair grow, I didn't really worry about whether it was going to offend anybody or not, because I had been doing what I thought the establishment had been telling me the right way to do things for a long time, and what they were telling me just wasn't working. You can't go around all the time doing what everybody tells you to do. So I decided it was time for me to start looking after my own future a little bit. And I had noticed playing a lot of the clubs in Texas that there was some young people that had sort of filtered their way into those redneck beer joints, and I noticed their hair was long, and they were trying to hide their hair under their coats, and yet they'd get out and dance San Antonio Rose and Fraulein. And this was right in the middle of the rock and roll area, and I said, well, wait a minute, there's something happening here. Maybe there's maybe the kids are liking country music for a change. And then I went to a place called Armadillo World Headquarters there in Austin, and run into a lot of good country music by young people. And so I said, well, here is an audience that I'm not getting to, and maybe I should. And I played the Armadillo World Headquarters. It was so good that I called Waylon. I said, Waylon, come on down. There's something you should see down here. And there was. There was just great enthusiasm for country music coming from the young people. And that's one of the things that started things turning around for me.
Well, you mentioned Waylon Jennings and your performances together. You became known as the Outlaws. There was an album that you both appeared on that had that name as well. Did you think of that whole concept of the Outlaws as being something that was finally packaged by the country music executive, something, an idea that you had started, but a package that they found a name for?
Well, I was really sort of proud of the fact that we wasn't really going along with the way that other people who didn't know us were saying that we should do our music. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to call that a rebellion, then it was. If they wanted to say that we were outlaws because we didn't, well, that's a good enough name. You know, I like Jesse James. They were colorful characters. We weren't robbing any banks or killing anybody, but if calling us outlaws was a way to get us out there and get us our music exposed, I wouldn't have any objections to it at all.
Another one of your breakthroughs was a 1975 album called Redheaded Stranger. And I want to play one of your songs from that record, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. What was different from the sound of this album, the way you were produced, the way you sang, your choice of material, from previous albums that that felt perhaps more like what you wanted to be doing?
Well, it's easy to see once you play the record that this is definitely a very underproduced song. There's just a very few musicians on there. But the fact that it was a country song, I felt like it should have been treated that way, and it didn't require or didn't call for all those big arrangements. So that's why it came out the way it did. A lot of people, even the record company, said, wait a minute, this might be a good demo, but it's not, you know, I don't think it's going to be something you'd want to release as an album. And I tried to convince them that, yes, this is something I want to release as an album.
So you had to fight to do it?
Every step of the way.
From the album Redheaded Stranger, let's hear Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
In twilight glow I see blue eyes crying in the rain. When we kissed goodbye and parted, I knew we'd never meet again. Love is like a dying ember, and only memories remain. And through
ages I'll remember. Blue eyes crying in the rain.
That's really beautiful. Did you feel like you could sing more freely, too, with less accompaniment behind you, that your voice could cut through better?
Well, yeah, I still think that, the simple arrangements are really the best. I want to do an album one day with just the voice and guitar. I think some other guys have done that in the past few years and been successful at it. And I really don't know whether to be successful or not, or be commercial again, as they say, but it's something that I want to do.
It seems to me from your autobiography that you've become much more conscious of your health in the past few years. You had a lung collapse in around 1981, and it sounds like you gave up, went into a rehab clinic, gave up drugs and maybe alcohol as well.
Well, let me put it this way. I believe in moderation, and
which isn't the way you live most of your life.
It wasn't the way I lived, no, but now I believe in it a lot more than I did back then.
You describe how you had to give up tripping on stage, because you were once tripping on stage and felt like your fingers were turning into claws on the banjo, and that you felt like you looked like a werewolf.
Mm-hmm, and people's heads were swelling.
Had you tripped a lot while performing, or did you give that up pretty early because it was so hard to keep the music together?
Well, yeah, it didn't take but one time to realize that's not the way to do a show. It didn't take a genius to figure that one out.
Being of superstar status now, do you feel lucky that came later in life after you'd done a lot of work and that you'd be better able to handle it?
Absolutely. I've always said that if I'd have gotten this successful back in those early years, I wouldn't have kept it. I'd have thrown it away. So it's a blessing that it came later in life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about some of your life and your music. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Enjoy talking to you.
Willie Nelson, recorded in 1988. Let's hear him sing one of his earliest and best-known songs.
I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for crying. And I'm crazy for loving you.
This is Fresh Air.